folks, welcome back to the Fearless Flyer Series 3 Insights Episode 10. My name is Grant and with me is my co-host.
Hello everyone, it's James.
We also have a guest co-host joining us today, Adrian. Adrian is currently a Airbus A380 pilot and he also flew the A320 series aircraft. So welcome, Adrian. Please tell us a bit about yourself.
Thanks very much, Grant. Great pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invite. I'm on the 380 at the moment. Got approximately 3,000 hours on the 380. Before that, flew the 320 for South African Airways out of Johannesburg. And been on Airbus now for probably coming up 13, 14 years of my life. Something different. And before that was on pretty much CRJs. The Dash 8 Q400 was my first command in terms of airline flying. And before that, general aviation, basically flying charters and corporate, which was pretty exciting. I flew the Hawker Siddeley 748, King Air 200s, King Air 1900s, in and out of bush trips and all over Africa, pretty much.
And you were also involved with crew resource management. Tell us a bit about that, please.
Yeah, with South African Airways, I did the course in CRM, crew resource management, with SMS, which is part of what we're discussing today, the safety management system, as well as human factors. And I used to present classes at South African Airways and also for Wits Medical School for doctors that were just about to go on to practical work. We did a CRM course for them just to show them the effects of human factors and what risk management and modules and checklists can actually do for you within every facet of life, not just aviation.
Yeah, that's good. And it's going to be great to have you on this episode because we are going to be having a look at that as well. So good to have you here.
Yeah. So in the last two episodes, we discussed the tragic loss of Air France Flight 447. It all stemmed from the probes which measure airspeed. These are called pitot tubes, and they iced up on the aircraft, and the aircraft computers got confused. The pilots who were flying the aircraft misinterpreted the situation and also became confused, which in essence led to the aircraft stalling at high altitude and entering what was to become a deep stall. This was unfortunately recognized too late for the pilots to recover from.
And now we go a step further and we look at the actions of the crews on two separate flights, both in essence the same type of aircraft. Both had technical issues leading to manual flight. However, the outcome was to differ significantly for each aircraft.
In the first episode of Air France 447, we talked about the design concept of the Airbus. It used side sticks for control, and in normal operations, the computers would not allow the aircraft to fly outside any certified limits. Basically, three computers run the system normally, and when one gets random information, it gets voted out by the other two. If all computers get random information, the computer basically says, "Hey, I can't work this out. You sitting in the pilot seat, have a go, but I'm not going to offer you any of the normal protection parameters because I don't know what's going on. So go fly your aircraft."
Yeah, this philosophy is applied not only on the Airbus 330 series, but also on the smaller A320 series Airbus as well.
I think it's probably also applied on all Airbus, including the 380 you probably fly at the moment. Would that be right, Adrian?
Yes, absolutely. It stems all the way basically from the A320 all the way up to the A380 through every series, pretty much.
Yeah. Okay, so in the last episode, we went on to discover how confusion and chaos took over in the cockpit. And finally, when the flight data and cockpit voices were recovered, answers to the mystery as to how the aircraft ended up and what became an unrecoverable situation were finally revealed. As a result, the industry made significant changes in the initial and ongoing training of pilots with a focus on operating the aircraft outside of normal operations at high altitudes.
Now, it must be stressed that the new training requirements that came out as a result of Air France 447 were unfortunately not mandated across the industry. These were simply recommendations. So now we're going to talk about two incidents that occurred over 5.5 years after the Air France 447 accident. Both incidents involved Airbus A320 series aircraft, and both had control issues, albeit brought on by two different technical problems, which led to both aircraft having to be manually flown at high altitude. However, the final outcome for these two flights would be completely different. So in case you've not heard the previous two episodes regarding Air France 447, let us briefly recap the basic control system of the Airbus, focusing on the A320 series. Adrian, seeing as you flew the A320 series, could you just briefly tell us about the flight control system and how they slightly differ from the A330?
Yeah, absolutely. The 320 series has seven computers that control the various flight control surfaces. These computers receive information from the pilot's sightseeing inputs, but also from other sources as well, such as the inertial sensors, air data sensors, which are giving information such as speed, angle of attack, altitude, to name a few. Plus, there are some other inputs from the aircraft avionics systems as well, such as the aircraft weight, the center of gravity. All these inputs are analyzed in real time, and which allows the computers to give an accurate command to the aircraft control surfaces that the pilot wants to move.
So the computer won't actually let the aircraft fly outside set limits, such as overspeeding, underspeeding, or stalling.
Yeah, and to recap, a stall occurs when the airflow over the top of the wing breaks away and becomes turbulent, which leads to a loss of lift. And in Series 1 of the Fearless Fly Episode 3, we talk about lift and the stall.
Well, anyway, these seven computers don't operate all the controls. For example, two of the seven just operate the normal elevator and stabilizers, whilst another two, called the flight augmentation computers, simply operate the electrical control element of the rudder. Also, just to add to that is, as you were saying earlier, in normal law, which we'll discuss later, you physically cannot stall an Airbus under normal law if all the computers are working.
But that does lead to dodgy information going in and out. But I think once that happens, the computers flick out and it goes into alternate law, doesn't it?
That's correct. So you get normal law, alternate law, and then what's called direct law, which it becomes the aircraft that you fly, the 777.
Okay. Oh, thanks. Yeah. She's an oldie, but a goodie.
Yes, she is. She is indeed. If you're starting at that base level, it can only get better.
That's true. We'll slag the 777 off another time, but let's stick to Airbus now.
No worries. Let's slag it off properly. You're right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. The first part of our story is about the rudder. So in order for us to understand the first part of the story, let's have a quick recap of the rudder. In Series 1, Episode 5, where we discussed basic flying controls, we also discussed the rudder.
Yeah, so briefly, the rudder is attached to the back of the vertical fin, and it moves left and right and is controlled by the pilot's feet on two pedals called rudder pedals. It's never used in flight, the only exception being that if an engine stopped, this would cause the aeroplane to want to yaw around towards the failed engine. And to stop this yawing motion, the pilot would then apply rudder toward the engine that was still running. So if the left engine fails, the pilot would then apply right rudder to counteract the yawing motion caused by the right engine producing all the power on that right side of the aircraft and no power coming from the left.
So in simple words, it keeps the aircraft going straight.
Yeah, so if we are cruising along and I only press the left rudder, the rudder at the back of the vertical stabilizer would move to the left. Anyone with a drink on their tray table at the back of the aircraft would have their drink spill out of the left-hand side of their cup, whilst those at the front of the aeroplane would have their drink spill out of the right side of their cups. The nose of the aircraft would yaw to the left. The right wing would be going faster than the left wing. Therefore, the right wing would now be developing more lift, and thus the secondary effect of the yaw is the aircraft would now roll to the left-hand side.
So that is the rudder, and its primary effect is yaw, and its secondary effect is roll in flight. Now we are ready, let's discuss the first event. The rudder on the A320 is at the back of the vertical stabilizer. It is pretty powerful, so as speed increases, the amount the pilot can deflect the rudder is automatically reduced. This is done in order to prevent the rudder imposing high structural loads upon the aircraft as the aircraft goes faster.
And it is the rudder travel limiter system that is controlled by the two flight augmentation computers, known as the FACs.
Sometimes if there's a problem somewhere in the rudder system, these FACs can be reset in flight by disengaging one flight augmentation computer, or one FAC, via a push button on the pilot's overhead panel as per the ECAM checklist procedure. Can you explain just what ECAM is briefly?
Yeah, the ECAM basically stands for Electronic Centralized Aircraft Monitoring System. It's basically what the old flight engineers would do. In this case, it displays a message of the problem and then allows a checklist to be followed in order to rectify the problem. This reset can generally remedy an issue.
However, there was a particularly troublesome A320-200 series aircraft with the registration Papa Kilo Alpha X-ray Charlie. It had been giving engineers and pilots headaches for a few months with the same issue. The issue was with the rudder traveler limiter system.
So there had been numerous maintenance issues with this rudder travel limiter system that started in May of 2014. Then in October of 2014, these issues started to occur more often, increasing in frequency in November with even more issues with it in December of that year.
On the 25th of December 2014, the captain of Indonesia Air Asia aircraft registration, Papa Kilo Alpha X-ray Charlie, had another message after engine start in Surabaya in Indonesia. The ECAM auto flight rudder traveler limiter system needed addressing by an engineer as there was a fault with it, so they returned to the stand.
Yeah, the engineer got on board and reset both FAC computers by resetting the circuit breakers. The captain then asked the engineer if he could do this whenever the problem occurred in flight, and the engineer stated to only do this if instructed by the ECAM.
Yeah, as a note, the ECAM procedure would never allow a reset of both circuit breakers in the scenario by the flight crew. It's only allowed a reset of the computers one at a time.
Yep, that would make sense.
The engineer then gets off the aircraft. Now, during the second pushback, starting the number two engine, the same problem occurs again. Auto flight rudder traveler limiter system appears on the ECAM. The pilot does the ECAM procedure, but this does not remedy the problem.
The pilot's talking to the engineer on the headset and he asks whether he could reset the FAC computer by pulling the FAC circuit breakers. Well, they're on the ground and the engineer's on the headset, so the engineer suggested he try that, but it did not work. They again returned to stand and then disembark all the passengers. The engineers replaced the number two FAC computer and finally the aircraft departed.
And this probably would have led to some deep frustration for pilots, crew, and passengers.
Yeah, I think so. That would be quite annoying, especially with the ongoing problem.
Oh, certainly. Now, to reiterate, the ECAM message and subsequent in-flight procedure only advises the pilots to reset one FAC off, then on, via the overhead push button. It does not say anything about pulling the circuit breakers.
Yeah, and my guessing was that the captain was getting pretty annoyed with the fact he was having to follow this ECAM procedure quite regularly and that the maintenance folk had not managed to fix this ongoing issue, which was happening more often with this particular aircraft.
Coming back onto stand with passengers having to be disembarked is highly frustrating for everyone involved, and more so if it's the same issue that keeps occurring.
So you can imagine that when the captain was reading the maintenance technical log for the same aircraft before his flight, now 3 days later on the 28th of December 2014, he must have been pretty alarmed to see the same fault had still been occurring, including just the day before as well. The flight he was about to perform on the 28th of December was Indonesia Air Asia Flight 8501, departing Surabaya in Indonesia for a flight to Singapore's Changi Airport. On board were two pilots and five cabin crew looking after 155 passengers, so 162 people in total.
The flight departed Surabaya at 5:35 a.m. local time and set course towards Singapore via the designated Air Traffic Control Airways and climbed to its cruise altitude 32,000 feet. The captain was from Indonesia and was the pilot monitoring. He had a lot of experience, over 20,000 hours with 4,687 hours on the Airbus A320.
Yeah, and next to him in the right seat was a French national with a relatively low total experience time of 2,247 hours and only 1,367 hours on the Airbus A320. and he was to be the pilot flying on the sector, while the captain was to be the pilot monitoring.
Flight 8501 reached its cruising altitude of 32,000 feet 14 minutes later at 5:49 a.m. Everything was going okay, but 11 minutes later at 6 a.m., the electronic centralized aircraft monitor, ECAM, came alive with auto flight rudder travel limiter system issue.
The captain basically followed the procedure and reset the two flight augmentation computers, or the FACs.
Then again, 9 minutes later, the same fault occurred again, and the captain did the same procedure yet again.
2 minutes after the second reset at 6:11 a.m., the pilots turned left 15 degrees to avoid some heavy weather and requested a climb to 38,000 feet. But they were told to stand by on the climb due to other traffic nearby.
Whilst waiting for the climb permission, the ECAM lit up again with guess what? Auto flight rudder travel limiter system issue. And for the third time in around 15 minutes, the captain again followed the same procedure.
Then the ECAM lights up again for the fourth time. No guessing for what this time. And the captain decided a different course of action was needed, as this was probably getting pretty ridiculous. This time he decided to reset the FACS circuit breakers. Remember, he'd seen the engineer do this on the ground 3 days earlier.
This was not an approved airborne procedure. However, he got out of his seat and reset both circuit breakers at the same time at 6:17 a.m.
Well, immediately, the autopilot and autothrottle disconnected. The flight control law went from normal to alternate. And because when the circuit breakers were both pulled, there was a slight amount of left rudder of approximately 2 degrees, the rudder locked into position with those circuit breakers being pulled. The secondary effect was the right wing was now going faster than the left wing. Therefore, the right wing was now producing more lift, and thus the aircraft quickly began to roll to the left.
The first officer was obviously startled and did not react to this roll until the aircraft had banked up to 54 degrees to the left.
Yeah, and putting a 54 degree bank angle into context, in normal flight operations, we generally don't ever exceed 30 degrees at angle of bank.
Do you think they'd feel this in the cabin?
Probably not, because you're close to the center of the rolling motion. If you're looking out the window, you'd probably notice it. You'd see it. What do you think, Adrian?
Yeah, I think, to be fair, I think if you're sitting in the back of the aircraft, you would feel it quite substantially, because the yawing motion, as you said, was sort of the pivot point is the CFGs towards the middle of the aircraft. But I think 54 degrees, yeah, I think the Gs, you'd definitely feel it, eh? Because with that in mind, the pull motion to keep it there, you'd pull some serious Gs, eh?
But that was if he was pulling, and I don't know whether he was pulling to stop that, to arrest that bank angle, the nose dropping at this stage. Let's see what happens. Yeah.
The first officer then overreacted twice to this roll by making a sharp right then sharp left bank input into his side stick. After that, he then made a nose-up input, causing the aircraft to enter a rather steep climb of 24 degrees nose-up, and in just under a minute, they went from 32,000 feet to 38,500 feet, which is around 10,000 feet per minute vertical rate of climb.
That's a good rate of climb. What do you reckon, Adrian?
Yeah, I would say that's pretty intense, which shows that the aircraft must have been in quite a steep descent to get that amount of climb out of it. So they had quite a high airspeed at the time.
And just for some context for the listener, you guys, how quickly would you say you climb on your way to cruise?
Well, at that altitude, you're probably looking at between 700 to 1,000 feet per minute would be about right.
Yeah, I would definitely say so at those altitudes, definitely, especially on a two-engine aeroplane. Yeah. For sure.
And well, we steady on, but also, but yeah, are you saying you go faster with the four engines?
Most certainly. Yeah, we still can maintain a bit over 1,000 foot per minute at those altitudes with the four engines going.
When we're heavy, we struggle a bit. But also, the pitch attitude, you can see 24 degrees nose up here. I mean, we change our pitch attitude. We're flying about 2.5 degrees. We'd lucky to change it another 2.5 degrees, 3 degrees max to go into a climb. So you're looking at a very, very slight pitch change, and this is 24 degrees.
That is quite excessive. As you said, I mean, from us, if we're cruising at 2.5 degrees, which would give us level flight, one more degree would give you 1,000-foot rate of climb.
Yeah. If you get a huge rate of climb altitude, there is a trade-off. And in this case, it is speed. 40 seconds later, probably at the peak of this random climb and at an altitude of 38,500 feet, the aircraft stalled. There was no smooth airflow over the wings, and gravity took over. The stall warning would keep going now from now on until the recording stopped. The aircraft now entered a descent at over 20,000 feet per minute, and it began to turn. Just under a minute later, the aircraft disappeared from Jakarta's radar screens. 50 seconds later, the aircraft impacted the Java Sea with no survivors.
On the 7th of January, divers found a section of the tail and faint pings from the vermilion-coloured recorder boxes that were also heard nearby. On the 12th of January, the flight data recorder was recovered, and the following day, the cockpit voice recorder was also recovered. Data from both devices was successfully downloaded, and it was quickly interpreted that the weather was not a factor in the accident.
From the cockpit voice recorders, there were many alarms going off, which made it very difficult to hear what the pilots were saying.
However, the two issues stood out. Firstly, the captain would have to get up from his seat to reset the FAC circuit breakers. Secondly, and more importantly, the captain probably realized that they were in a stalled situation as he kept saying to the first officer, "Pull down, pull down."
As the aircraft approached the top of this unplanned climb, he must have gotten back into his seat as the captain made an input into his side stick control for 2 seconds. And then 15 seconds later, he made another input.
During this stage, the captain pressed his priority takeover button for 2 seconds.
Now, as the aircraft passed 28,000 feet in descent, the aircraft was pretty much wings level. The aircraft's pitch attitude was 0 degrees, so its nose was pointing at the horizon. However, the angle of attack was 41 degrees, which was giving the aircraft a descent rate of 15,500 feet per minute. The aircraft was now in an extremely deep stall, the airflow over the wings being severely disrupted. The only way to unstall the wings and get the aircraft flying again was to pitch the nose down.
The captain had a side stick control pushed pretty much full forward in an attempt to get his nose down, whilst the co-pilot had his side stick control pulled pretty much all the way back.
Remember, Airbus logic dictates that if two opposing inputs are made on the pilot's side stick controls, the computer averages them out. In this case, regarding the elevators, it leaves them not moving at all, so in a neutral position.
Again, the captain said, "Pull down, pull down." In total, the captain would say, "Pull down" 9 times. The first 2 times with the aircraft around 35,000 feet. But what actually does the phrase "pull down" mean?
It's a really confusing one. I remember you've got an Indonesian guy speaking English to a French national guy, right? So in an aircraft, if you push the control column or side stick away from you, that is pushing forward, the nose of the aircraft will go down. Conversely, if you pull it back towards you in a rearwards motion, the nose of the aircraft will go up. So I ran this question by quite a few pilots that I know. One of them is a PPL, but most of them are all experienced pilots, Boeing and Airbus. And I asked them this simple question. I'm going to give you a command. You can't ask what it is, but you've got a control column or a side stick, and the command is pull down. Which way will you move the control column? And here are their answers.
I would instinctively pull, which okay. would be pull back. Okay.
And what would that do to the nose of the aircraft?
It'll bring the nose up.
Backwards. Okay, you're going to pull it backwards, which is going to force the nose to do what? Go up.
If you say pull down, the first thing you'll do is pull back.
Okay, pull back. So what does that make the plane do?
Pitch up.
I pull.
Pull it towards you.
Yes. pull down, pull down, pull down, which way would you move the stick?
I would probably pull.
Yep. So you pull the stick towards you.
Yep.
Which would make the nose go.
It would make the nose go up.
Okay.
Now, when I gave them this scenario and they gave me the answer, and then I said, now the store warning's going off. Which way do you move it?
So now the store warning's going.
Push.
If the store warning's going, what would you do if I said pull down?
Push.
Then the store warning's going. What are you going to do with the stick?
The first thing you do in a store is push.
They all said push forward because the store warning's on. Hey, just with regard to pushing forward or pulling and stalling, you want to talk something about that, Adrian?
Yeah, people forget that when we were taught to fly airplanes, that the initial part of it was in a stall. You were always taught to fly it out on the stall, which meant you never pushed forward. You tried to add power to regain speed, and you basically flew it out on what was called the stick shaker or the stall warning. I remember in airlines of previous that if you lost more than 50 foot, it was actually a fail, considered a fail, and some made it up to 250 foot was the maximum you could actually lose. So it's completely different to what we are taught today in the push, roll, power, stabilize of getting out of a stall. Now, I was saying a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, who was the ex-world aerobatic champion, was actually one of the first guys to go over and do this whole upset recovery training. And when he came back and introduced it at South African Airways, the main part of it wasn't, in essence, the procedure. It was the actual call of push, roll, power, stabilize, because the term push took you out of a situation where you were now in a state of shock, which we consider today as a sort of startle effect, which can last up to 56 seconds. And it took away the startle and just made you do one thing, and that's push. And regardless of the aircraft position or attitude or whatever you're doing, if you push, it generally unloads the wing, which unloads the stall, which enables you to gain control of the aircraft again much easier.
Yes, because technically speaking, if you push forward and float the airplane into a zero G situation, technically speaking, if you've got zero airspeed, the plane's not stalled, is it? It's kind of floating in effect.
Absolutely. And you unloading the wing will give you control back of the aircraft. It's the severe loading that limits your ability to maneuver because, you know, you're in a situation where the aircraft shouldn't be in. So it's out of its normal envelope.
And especially at high altitude, you've got to push forward a long way to get that airflow going over the wings because the air is very rarefied. So you need to do quite a significant push at altitude.
Absolutely. There's a lot more, because the air is so thin up there, you need a lot more control maneuvers to get what you want out of it, fortunately.
Yeah. Okay, so cracking on. So 30 seconds after passing 28,000 feet in descent, the captain again pressed his priority takeover button on his side stick, and this time he pressed it for 5 seconds, but nothing changed. If he had said at the time that he pressed this, "I have control," first officer would have likely let go of his side stick, and that 5-second priority takeover button would have given the captain full control of the aircraft. But the co-pilot still had the side stick pulled all the way back.
You're probably thinking, especially if you've listened to our previous episode on Air France 447, why didn't the captain use his priority takeover button on his side stick control to give him full control again by overriding the first officer's side stick?
The side stick priority takeover push button on the Airbus 320 is designed in a way that should a side stick get jammed, as it might have been perceived to have been happening with the first officer holding his stick fully back at this stage, then the other flight crew member must push their takeover priority push button for at least 40 seconds.
40 seconds is a long time, especially under stress. As a result, despite the captain trying to input the correct nose-down procedure, by pushing his side stick fully forward to unstall the aircraft's wings, the co-pilot's pulling fully back on his side stick neutralized the commands to the elevator flight controls.
Yeah, so what came out of the investigation? There was no high-level training had been done for this airline, despite the fact that the recommendations from the Air France 447 report, which had come out 2 years earlier, that crews be trained in high-level jet upsets. Maintenance practices also left a lot to be desired as well. As a result, the operator of the aircraft implemented the numerous safety recommendations that the accident report highlighted. Jet upset and recovery training was implemented, along with more training in high-altitude manual flight. More emphasis on standard calls was mandated, so that in the event of a high nose-up attitude, the calls to be made pitch, pitch, and maintenance was slapped across the wrist for what in essence was allowing this fault for the rudder limiter traveller to go on too long, and just fixing the problems using a simple bite test and saying it was working okay again.
One of the other situations that actually is a massive problem with Airbus, and as you know, flying aircraft of standard controls, is that you can never see what the other guy is doing on his side stick. That's something really important to note on an Airbus, is that if I'm pulling full back, you can't feel it on your side, which has also led to many problems in Airbus where you don't actually know what the guy is doing.
Aren't they going to give feedback? And is it one of the new ones they're looking at is providing feedback in the stick, you know, artificial feedback?
They were talking about it in terms of dual motion. So in other words, if I pull back, your stick moves back as well. Because you know when you're flying in the left-hand seat, if you don't feel the FO pulling back or pushing forward, you can physically see it in front of you. And that's an important part of flying.
Yeah.
Whereas on the Airbus, you can't see that because it's where it's sat, number one. And number two, you can't feel it on your side stick. There's no movement.
I remember when I was in training, you quite often have your hand on the control column just very loosely in case they do
just
something.
Just to feel.
Absolutely.
And that's a big thing in ab initio training, is that you know, hands and feet on, and you can at least feel what the other person's doing, and that gives you a sense of what's going on. Where Airbus has got none of that. Your side stick always sits neutral.
Yeah.
I think Gulfstream, the private jet manufacturer, they have side sticks, and their latest one, they've managed to work out a way of having them both move
at the
same time.
That is correct. Yes, 100%. The G650 has it, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe Airbus will implement it psychologically that, hey, we've got away with it for so long, but there have been some issues that have occurred where perhaps if they had them both moving at the same time, this accident we might not be talking about.
Perhaps it's just another hole in the Swiss cheese effect, essentially.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this accident had way too many similarities to the Air France 447 accident, which was very frustrating indeed to see another accident in this industry occur again, whereby if this particular company had implemented the recommendations and the lessons learned from Air France 447, this accident would likely have never have occurred.
Absolutely. And it's easy on the surface to assume here from what happened was that the co-pilot didn't unstall the aircraft, but he definitely didn't do it intentionally.
And we have talked about the Swiss cheese model in our episode on crew resource management, series one, episode 32.
And just to reiterate, the Swiss cheese model is sort of, it discusses Swiss cheese that has holes in it of various sizes. And if you were to cut lots of slices in Swiss cheese, with each slice representing an element of operating an aircraft. And by coincidence, all the slices had a hole in exactly the same place, whereby you could put a stick all the way through those aligned holes, you would then have an accident. So a hole that you could see the whole way through the cheese would create an accident. In essence, the more robust your operation is, the smaller the holes are in the slices of Swiss cheese, and therefore the less likelihood there is of being an accident.
Absolutely. So if we discuss the Swiss cheese in the case of Indonesian Air Flight 8501, a failure of the airline to implement high-level jet upset recovery training by the company meant a slice of Swiss cheese with a big hole in it, not fixing the ongoing maintenance issue for the rudder, another big hole in that slice of Swiss cheese.
Not enforcing the correct phraseology between pilots, another hole. Not following ECAM procedures, another hole.
You could analyze and the list would go on. But on this day, 28th of December 2014, sadly, all those Swiss cheese slices with their big holes in them easily lined up. And the result being not only very sad for the families, but the industry as well.
Now, just over 53 days before the demise of AirAsia Indonesia Flight 8501, on the 5th of November 2014, Lufthansa flight LH1829 departed Bilbao in northern Spain, bound for Munich in Germany. The aircraft was an Airbus A321-200 and had a total of 109 people on board.
Yeah, the co-pilot was flying the sector to Munich. He had a total flying experience of 6,473 hours. And most of those, just under 5,200, was on this Airbus type. And the captain, he had a total experience of just under 16,500 hours, with over 12,400 on this particular type of aircraft. And he was the pilot monitoring.
You could definitely call that a very experienced crew.
Yeah.
As the flight was climbing out of Bilbao, passing nearly 31,000 feet, the co-pilot noticed a weird reading on his airspeed display and he disengaged the autopilot.
The aircraft immediately began to descend, and despite the co-pilot putting an aft movement into his side stick, the aircraft was not responding as it should, and it continued to descend. 45 seconds after the autopilot had been disengaged, he verbalized this problem to the captain, and the captain took control.
At this stage, the aircraft had a rate of descent of around 4,000 feet per minute and a nose pitch down attitude of 3.5 degrees.
The captain put in a full nose up command on a side stick, and the aircraft nose finally began to rise and the rate of descent decreased to zero. Level flight was now able to be maintained.
Now, in order to hold this level flight, the captain had to maintain a continuous backside stick input of more than 50% in order to hold the altitude of 27,000 feet. The autopilot could not be engaged, and the trim system was limited.
They then checked their indicated airspeed was correct by cross-checking against their pitch and power settings. So they initially did the unreliable airspeed checklist. They then searched through the onboard checklist called the QRH, which stands for Quick Reference Handbook. And this has all the emergency procedures for abnormal situations written in it. And there was nothing in the QRH which related to the dilemma that they currently faced.
So the crew decided to reset the FAC computers one at a time as per the QRH instructions. This did not remedy the problem.
And just quickly, the QRH is the same as the ECAM. You could either use the QRH or the ECAM, I take it.
That's correct, yeah. So in future times, the only thing in the QRH is actually now is the smoke removal and the emergency evacuation on the ground. That's okay. All that's in the QRH. Now everything else is on the ECAM of the Airbus.
Okay. So QRH and ECAM, same thing. Okay, cool.
Same, identical. Yeah.
So not long after this, the aircraft sent an automated message to the Lufthansa Technical Center, which had in it the angle of attack values for the three air data inertial referencing units called the ADIRUs. These were fed individually from three dedicated angle of attack sensors on the forward fuselage of the aircraft, each ADIRU having its own angle of attack sensor.
The crew sent a message to the technical guys with a brief description of the issue and asked whether a simultaneous reset of the FACs was a way to fix the issue. The response was to try it and be aware that the aircraft would be an alternate law.
This did not work, and the maintenance technicians, having analysed the data sent by the aircraft, then suggested that they try and turn off one of the air data reference units, number 3. But there was still no joy once they'd tried this.
More analysing was done and more messages to the aircraft. This time, the ground maintenance centre discovered that the angle of attack probes 1 and 2 may have frozen up, by coincidence at the same angle.
Well, in essence, under this system logic, the computer would then vote out the third angle of attack sensor despite it being the only correct one at the time. So the engineers suggested turning off ADR2. So nearly 1 hour after the problem had began, they turned off ADR2 and the system changed to alternate law. No continuous back pressure was required on the pilot's control stick in order to maintain level flight. And good news, the auto trim and more importantly, the autopilot began to function correctly again.
The crew had saved the day.
Yep, seems that way.
Following a full investigation, it was found that the angle of attack sensors 1 and 2 had frozen, passing 19,500 feet whilst the aircraft was climbing. The flight computer was programmed to disregard the third angle of attack sensor, despite it being the only correct one. On the 9th of December, just over a month after the incident, with Lufthansa flight 1829, an emergency airworthiness directive was issued by Airbus to all A318 to A321 operators, informing them of the issue, and a specific procedure was published in order for crews to successfully deal with a similar event should it occur in the future.
One of the concepts of the angle of attack sensors being fed into the aircraft computers was to remove a potential problem such as an inadvertent stall. But in doing so, it left a latent opportunity to create an unforeseen problem. The crew of this Lufthansa flight did an outstanding job of analysing the problem that presented itself that was beyond the scope of the original design concept by the engineers.
So looking at a Swiss cheese model, a big hole appeared in a piece of Swiss cheese as a latent technical issue. The pieces of Swiss cheese that followed, such as crew focusing on flying the aircraft, checking their initial attitude and power settings, liaising with maintenance and resolving the issue, no other holes ever had a chance of appearing in these slices of Swiss cheese.
You could also add further slices of unholy cheese, such as the crew's training, great technical support, good comms between the crew and the maintenance center. There was never any chance of the holes lining up in the case of this Lufthansa flight.
Yeah, so although the initial technical issues were different from AirAsia Indonesia and the Lufthansa flights, the outcome was completely different. If you swap the problems around, I dare say with the different training, experience levels and engineering backup, the Lufthansa crew would probably have had a successful outcome given the AirAsia scenario as well. What do you guys think?
Maybe. Hopefully.
Do you know what the difference is? It's exactly as you say, man. When you've got that much experience on the aircraft and your training's been of a sort of a higher level, you tend to fall back on basics, and basics is just to keep the airplane flying.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most important thing. You know, with regards to the first one, just the fact that you had to get out of your seat to pull a circuit breaker means you should never have been doing that, ever.
Yeah, exactly.
So that just explains what it's all about. The fact that it is on the back wall means that's not for the pilots to touch. In terms of doing something that you think might help, doesn't always end up the right way.
Yeah.
So why have we looked at these two flights in this one episode? One was an accident that was avoidable, and the other most of you will never have heard of. However, the actions of a crew, robust training, experience, and company support prevented an accident.
Now, in my research on Air France 447, I read a lot of articles about the pilots causing crashes. Some went further to state that pilots should be eliminated from the flight deck, as they are always responsible for crashing aeroplanes nowadays. And technically, they are right. The pilot is the one at the controls pointing the aeroplane towards its final destiny. Statistically speaking, though, flying is much safer nowadays, but planes still crash, and pilots are the easy target to pin a blame on.
Yeah, the pilot is also the last line of defense in an accident. They're the last slice of the Swiss cheese in an accident chain. There will always be some form of a hole in their slice of cheese, Swiss cheese, as no one is perfect. But training and experience will ensure that this is a tiny hole and that doesn't line up with the big holes next door to them.
In the news, it's always easy to blame the pilots for crashing an aircraft. But what you don't hear is that every day, somewhere in the world, a pilot prevents a crash. And that is not newsworthy. So in the next few episodes, we're going to be discussing pilots who are the last line of defense and save the aircraft, such as we've just heard about with the Lufthansa LH1829 crew.
Adrian, thank you very much for joining us. Have you got anything else you want to add? Anything you want to add there, Adrian?
No, thanks very much for having me. It was a great pleasure. And very insightful and nice to hear it from a different perspective, especially I think we look at things differently because we fly Airbus, but it's also nice to hear it from the other side, just from anybody talking about it and seeing. And I think one of the most important things to remember with regards to this is we talk about the Swiss cheese, we talk about, it's always pilot's fault and stuff, but I've yet to go to work with a pilot that wanted to flipping end up in a crash. I think we've got to remember that, you know, in the long run, everyone tries to do their best. And that's when, as you said, training, experience all comes to play, but no one really goes to work wanting to crash an airplane.
No, that's true. And you, given how many planes we have flying every day, I'd only guess, but, you know, as you say, most of us, if not, I'd say everyone, there's been the odd one we've talked about in the past that's got a bit loony, but we've hopefully eliminated that with procedures that we've put in place nowadays. But as you say, no one goes to work with the intention of crashing a plane. As no one goes driving down the road to crash a car, but people crash cars, and there's a lead up to why a crash.
These things happen sometimes.
Hey, so thank you very much for joining us. Much appreciated.
Thanks for joining us, Adrian. Much appreciated. And until next time, speak to you later.
Yep. And thanks to everyone for your ears for listening. And I hope you've enjoyed the episode. And we look forward to talking to you in the next one.